I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, Paul Moore. He died yesterday at the age of 83. Moore was raised in wealth, but later lived and worked among the poor. He gained a reputation as one of the most liberal bishops in the church. We'll listen back to a 1997 interview with him. Also, happy birthday to James Brown. Tomorrow is his birthday, and we listen back to interviews with two of his former sidemen, Maceo Parker and Bootsy Collins. And film critic David Edelstein reviews X2, X-Men United. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal appeals panel has ruled that much of the new campaign finance law is unconstitutional. The court said the government can't ban unions and corporations from giving political parties big, unregulated donations known as soft money. President Bush visited a California defense plant today to promote his tax cut plan. The president told workers at United Defense Industries that a big tax cut would stimulate the economy and create jobs.
I proposed a robust tax package to the United States Congress of at least $550 billion. The reason I did so is because economists have taken a look at that package and say that when it passes, 1 million new jobs would be created by the year 2004.
Democrats say the president's plan would create huge deficits without having a significant effect on job growth. The government reported today that the economy lost 48,000 non-farm jobs last month, but the news wasn't all bad. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The April unemployment report showed that while businesses still weren't hiring last month, the economy actually lost fewer jobs than anticipated. Jim Glassman is chief economist at J.P. Morgan Chase. He says while unemployment may yet creep a bit higher, he thinks there are also growing signs the much-talked-about turnaround for the economy is at hand.
Our expectation is that the labor market will start to stabilize, and then sometime late summer, fall, we'll start to see much more decent pickup in job growth.
The unemployment rate in April was up 0.2% to 6%. That matches the rate for December of last year, the highest the jobless rate has been in 8 years. However, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, focusing on lower-than-expected job losses, ended the day up 1.5%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon has taken one more step toward establishing military courts for enemy combatants. Defense Department lawyers issued legal instructions for conducting tribunals should President Bush order them, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The instructions detail which crimes could subject someone to a tribunal and lay out the duties of the prosecutors and defense counsel. Military officials say they're written to protect sensitive national security information. Critics worry the Pentagon may take such concerns too far. For example, the instructions state that civilian defense lawyers may be barred from some hearings, even though they have a security clearance. The tribunals are intended only for non-citizens. Among the first tried could be some of the 600 prisoners still held from the war in Afghanistan. Legal analysts say the Pentagon already has named some commission members, though officials here do not confirm this. Once members are at work, defense officials say tribunals could be up and running very soon. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 128 points, or 1.5%, to close at 85.82 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld met with his British counterpart today in London. He warned that although the major battles in Iraq have been won, the fighting still isn't over.
It would be a terrible mistake to think that Iraq is a fully secure, fully pacified environment. It is not. It is dangerous.
Rumsfeld said it's still too soon to say how long U.S. forces will have to stay in Iraq and how many troops will be needed. The World Health Organization has removed the United States and the United Kingdom from the list of nations with active epidemics of severe acute respiratory syndrome. NPR's Richard Knox has more.
The WHO's list of affected countries is based on evidence of SARS transmission within the country in the previous 20 days. That's 2 times the incubation period for SARS. If that much time passes with no new infections, the WHO says that means there are no active chains of transmission outside healthcare settings. That is, no community outbreaks. The United States continues to report new cases of SARS. The WHO says that's due to new cases coming into the country from Asia, where SARS outbreaks are still expanding. The WHO counts 54 probable cases here. A week ago, there were 39. There have been no SARS deaths in the United States. The WHO says the U.S. and other countries should be vigilant so imported cases of SARS don't touch off new outbreaks. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 30 points or 2% to close at 1,502. For the week, the NASDAQ was up 68 points. The S&P 500 gained 13 points to close at 930. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Aircast Foundation, working to support medicine and science through the funding of orthopedic research, on the web at aircastfoundation.org.
Holy Invertary Gross. Paul Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, died yesterday at age 83 after suffering from brain and lung cancer. He was a longtime outspoken advocate for social change inside and outside the church. He pushed for the ordination of women and was the first bishop to ordain an openly lesbian priest. He fought for civil rights, opposed the war in Vietnam, sought aid for inner-city residents, and supported John Lennon's efforts to become a U.S. citizen. Moore was ordained in 1949 and gave his last sermon as bishop 40 years later. Although he worked tirelessly to help the poor, he came from a wealthy family. He grew up in a house in New Jersey staffed by butlers and maids, with a three-hole golf course just beyond the garden. Terry spoke with Paul Moore in 1997 and asked if he was ever conflicted over whether to keep his money or give it away.
My first wife and I worried about this, especially when we were living in Jersey City amongst many poor people who didn't have enough clothes and sometimes not enough to eat, and I could have written them a check for $100. But that would have been a very bad thing for the dynamics of the work we were doing. But what we decided to do was to live in a relatively modest fashion. In Jersey City, we lived right there next to the church, very modestly. And then to give away whatever of our income was left after we spent what we needed to spend to charity of one kind or another. And then later on, I took a big hunk of it and made a foundation, which I could use anonymously to help other causes. And over the years, I've given away a lot of the capital as well as the income, but not to the point of St. Francis. I did not strip down in the public square, and I still wear clothes.
Now, you said before that you could have written out a check to poor people for, you know, $100 to help them out, but that would have been bad for the dynamics of what you were trying to do. I want you to elaborate on that.
Well, that would have meant that they would be coming there for a handout, period. And we probably would have had 1,000 people at the door. And just giving out checks, that was not what we were about. But that had to do with the church and parish being the center of a community of love, God's love, human love, starting at the altar where we had our Eucharist each day, and spreading out into the community in terms of ministering to poor people in their hardship, but also in trying to change the system and developing a network through the city as best we could by establishing cell groups in different neighborhoods, by getting to know the children and through them their parents, by encouraging rent strikes and so forth. Doing this in order to try to change the system. And if we had become just a handout place, first of all, we would have eventually had to set up guidelines and become just sort of a second-rate foundation, and that was not what we were there for. So my extra money that we had, I gave outside the parish to other causes within the church and in the world.
You said that religion wasn't an important part of your life until about the 11th grade. What religion were you born into?
Episcopal Church. My mother was a Presbyterian, actually, but she went to the Episcopal Church because my father went there. Then he quit, she continued. But she used to take me to church every Sunday. I didn't go to Sunday school. First time I went, they threw spitballs at me because I didn't know the kids. So I never went back. And I kept going every Sunday. It was very boring. And I used to look at the stained glass windows and fiddle with the prayer books. Went to St. Paul's School. It was still pretty boring, but a little nicer because it was an atmosphere of a school there and the prayers were more youth-friendly.
Well, part of what changed you was your first confession.
That's right.
What made you decide to take this first, to give this first confession?
Well, there was a master on the faculty there who was a priest, and we were a so-called low church school. However, he was very interested in what we used to call Anglo-Catholicism, which was the high church or Catholic part of our Episcopal heritage. And the Anglo-Catholic churches had incense, they had bells, they had people crossed themselves, people genuflected. It was a whole other thing. It was Catholicism. And he used to take us to high church ceremonies, which were rather mysterious and wonderful and beautiful. And as adolescents, we were drawn to that. And also the fact, he said, don't tell the rector of the school I took you because he wouldn't approve. So there was sort of sub rosa, which is also for a teenager very interesting. And then he talked about confession, which was always available in our church, but very little used, and encouraged us to do that. And we were a little scared of the idea. So a monk came to school, and I was asked to go see him, which I did, and talk to him about why should I confess to a man when I could confess directly to God? And he said, well, of course you can confess to God directly, but when you make your confession, it's a sacrament. It's a deeper kind of assurance of forgiveness. So looking back was sort of funny, but at the time was very embarrassing, naturally, and I made my confession to him later that night with clammy hands and shaking fingers. And when he pronounced the absolution, as a priest, I absolve you from all your sins in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. I was overwhelmed by a presence of God, by a sense of peace and joy and wonder. I can't describe it. And walked home to my room in the clouds and made my communion the next day, and it was as if I'd received the sacrament for the first time. And that was a turning point in my life.
And did you stay with the Anglican Church?
Oh, yes.
After that? You know, you became a Marine and fought in World War II shortly after your conversion experience. And your conversion experience transformed you, but I'm sure the war did too. Did you feel at all like it was changing you in a different direction, away from the like open-heartedness that you wanted to have as a convert, as a new convert?
Well, yes and no. I think first of all, I had some questions about whether a Christian should go to war, but my rector had been in World War I, had been gassed. He was a wonderful and very devout man. I respected him enormously, and he felt, as I did then, that it was the lesser of two evils, that Hitler and, because the Japan wasn't in it then, but Nazism, if that took over the world, beginning with Europe, that it would be a total disaster for the church and for civilization, and that this is one of the few times where it was justified to fight, a just war, if you will. So I went in, and once I decided to go in, I gobbled up the Marine Corps hook, line, and sinker, Semper Fidelis, rough, tough, leatherneck. We had bayonet training where we had to scream and yell and stick our bayonets into straw dummies and knock heads off dummies, heads that were dressed up to look like Japanese oriental heads. It was absolutely terrible. But this process was a toughening up of our psyche. I was a young callow kid from Yale. I had to be toughened to go through the stuff we would go through. And so the training was necessary. But it made us impervious to some of the horrors that we were asked to do. I shot one man I know without any need to have shot him just because he was lying there. And I just shot him. And this happened again and again and again. But so we had to have been toughened. But at the same time, it did make me realize that my faith was strong enough to get me through that kind of horror and come out on the other side.
You were hit by a grenade during the war, and it punctured a lung.
Actually, I was throwing a grenade.
It was your own grenade that blew up.
I threw a grenade at a machine gun nest, which was killing some of our men, and as I knelt upright to throw it, I got hit by the machine gun I was throwing the grenade at. So I was hit by a bullet, went through my chest, past my heart. The doctors thought it should have hit the heart, but they figured the heart was on the inbeat when the bullet went by. So I was very lucky, to put it mildly.
But at the time, you thought you were dying. And you write
that. At the time,
that,
I thought I was dying.
And you write that this near-death experience wasn't a spiritual experience at all. What were you expecting, and how did it compare?
Well, I wasn't expecting anything. I hadn't really thought much about it. Death was all around us. We were getting quite casual about death. I remember running out under fire to get a package of cigarettes. I risked my life to get a package of cigarettes. My friends had been killed. My man I'd seen bleeding in my arms. And death became so common. It's hard to believe that when I finally got hit, okay, so I got hit this time, and I lay down after this bullet went in, the wind was going in and out of, blubbering in and out of this wound in my lung, and I thought I was dying. I gave over the platoon to the sergeant, and then I fainted. But before I fainted, I thought, well, I'm supposed to remember my whole life. That didn't happen. Then I said, oh, I better say a prayer, which I said a prayer, commending myself to God. But it wasn't a deep business of seeing Jesus coming to get me or anything like that. It was sort of almost casual. Now, if I had died, I don't know whether it would have been that casual or whether it would have been a much deeper experience. I presume it would have been. But if I died going back to the aid station on that stretcher when I was already unconscious, what I just recounted would have been my experience of death, at least the conscious part of dying. And whether something else opens up after you lose consciousness, if you are dying, is one of the great mysteries.
Paul Moore, speaking with Terry Gross in an interview from 1997. Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, died yesterday at age 83. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with former New York Episcopal Bishop Paul Moore. The interview was conducted in 1997. Paul Moore died yesterday at age 83.
Because you're a bishop in the Anglican Church and not the Roman Catholic Church, mm-hmm. you were able to marry and have children. Celibacy is not required of priests in the Anglican Church. Do you think you could have been a celibate priest, or is that something? Do you disagree with the concept that you need to...
I disagree totally with that concept. Mm-hmm. There are some priests who are drawn to the celibate life. We have celibates in our church. We have monks who are celibate by vow, and we have secular priests who have not gotten married for whatever reason and are celibate. But that wasn't for me. I mean, I wanted to have children. I'd fallen in love before I went to the seminary. I was married before I became a priest. And I feel very deeply that my marriage and experience in my family, not only the joys of it, but some of the pain and sorrow of family life gave me, and the difficulty of marriage gave me an understanding and counseling people who were having marital problems and family problems that I never could have had as a single priest. And this isn't putting down celibacy for those who want it.
You were a father during those difficult-to-be-a-parent times of the 1960s.
The 60s.
I think some of your children were teenagers during the 60s.
Indeed, they were.
When all the sexual standards of the past were being challenged by young people. And you write in your book that you wanted to give your children as much freedom as possible, although you forbade drugs with whatever power you had to do that. But that, you know, you believe the culture suffered from too much sexual puritanism. So when your children were coming of age, how did you deal with issues of their sexuality and of how they could deal with boyfriends and girlfriends in the house?
Well, that was tough. I mean, we started by being very much against anybody having intercourse until they were married. And then the next step is, as we were exposed to the liberal thinking of the 60s, which you just described, we began to think this was a little bit too tight, and my wife would teach my teenage daughters about birth control so that if they did have intercourse, they would be safe. This is long before AIDS, of course. As far as the dope goes, we are vigorously against hard drugs of any kind, but we were a little loose about marijuana. I remember going upstairs, my 15-year-old was suddenly interested in growing plants in a window box. And I thought, isn't this nice? And I looked up, and of course, the plants were marijuana.
Right.
So we went through that kind of thing. But right. You just struggle through. We were making ad hoc decisions in the midst of the event. We didn't have a hard ideology we insisted on, and I'm sort of glad we didn't. I think, looking back, I think we did okay. I might have made some changes in retrospect.
You supported the ordination of women in your church, and you were the first bishop to ordain a lesbian priest within the church. How did you come around to that thinking? You didn't always support the ordination of women or gays.
Well, I think one of the reasons I came around so quickly to the ordination of women is I had six daughters and a wife.
Were they pushing you?
Indeed, they were. I remember one time when we were up in the Adirondacks, I said, girls, why don't you clear the table? Girls? Why should the girls clear the table? So, you know, that taught me one lesson.
All right.
And, well, the whole ethos of the women's movement was very much part of their thinking and my wife's thinking and my thinking, and it wasn't long before I realized it was just absolutely ridiculous not to allow women to be priests. Historically, although theology says that God is beyond gender, neither man nor woman, historically, God has been looked at as a father figure, as a male figure, as a God of judgment. And I think the Roman Catholic Church has sort of made up for that by their cult of the Virgin. But in our church, the Virgin Mary didn't have much of a role. And therefore, I think our people were starved for a femininity in their devotion. And so when women became priests and you could hear a woman's voice reading the Bible, a woman's voice celebrating the Eucharist, you gradually realized that Jesus Christ took on human flesh, happened to be a man, but he took on all human flesh, and that God made us in his image, both man and woman, and that's in the Bible. But that was a very deep reason to have women priests, as well as the obvious reason of its being discriminatory not to.
What about gays and lesbians?
Gays and lesbians, again, what happened to me was that a gay woman who was out of the closet, as it were, she'd written articles for a gay magazine, came to see me, wanted to be a priest. She was totally qualified, brilliant academically, and a fine person. But she was out of the closet. And I said, no way could we ordain you. And the standing committee, who had to okay, too, I wouldn't even think of it. I floated by them. They said half of them would resign if I did this. So I said, no. She said, well, I'm going to go to seminary anyway. I said, well, feel free. So she came back 3 years later and asked again. By that time, a lot had happened. Women were beginning to be ordained. And so it was possible. And I thought to myself, over those 3 years, the only difference between Ellen Barrett, her name, and maybe 20% of our clergy who were gay and in the closet is she is more open, more honest. Not that they didn't have a right to be private, but she also had a right, it seemed to me, to be open. So I headed one of my chapters, my last book, about this issue. Is honesty a bar to ordination? And I couldn't answer yes. So I said, okay, Ellen, we'll try it. The standing committee reluctantly went along. We ordained Ellen, and all hell broke loose. Later on, some of the parishes refused to pay their dues to the diocese. I had hearings when I was repudiated. It was all over the papers. I had special secretary to answer the mail, and I finally, there was an attempt to censure me in the House of Bishops. So it was an enormous explosion. People say, you're so courageous. I said, it's like being courageous to say you're courageous when you're standing in the middle of the road and get hit by a truck.
Any regrets?
No, but I'm not sure I would have been as courageous as I was if I'd known what was going to happen. I hope I would have been.
But I'd like to take you back to 1949, which was your first Christmas as an ordained priest. In fact, I think it was your first Eucharist.
You're right.
Would you share some of your memories of that first Eucharist in 1949?
Well, it was in Jersey City, and it was a wonderful moment for me. The congregation was already integrated. A lot of the boys we'd begun to reach had become acolytes. And to be able to stand at the altar, especially in that inner city situation, and realize you were celebrating the Eucharist for Christmas when our Lord became a poor child and changed, redeemed the whole life of human beings by that becoming man, becoming human. And the other thing that was so strange was that Christmas was a very cruel time for many of our people because they couldn't afford to buy presents for their children. We had attempted suicides. We had murders. We had alcoholism. Whenever Christmas came, it was a time of horror stories as well as a time of beauty. And so I've always remembered that. And if only people understood, especially poor people understood, that the message of Christmas was that God became poor, then perhaps they wouldn't have this awful tension between the materialistic Christmas and advertisements and the little they're able to do to their own families. So there was always this tension, as there was in the original Christmas, a homeless woman having an illegitimate child in a stable, and our image of all the lovely carols and golden Christmases that we have.
Paul Moore speaking with Terry Gross. She spoke with him shortly before Christmas in 1997. Moore, the former Episcopal Bishop of New York, died yesterday at age 83. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And by Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, to celebrate James Brown's 70th or 75th birthday, no one is sure which, we listen back to interviews with his former sidemen, Maceo Parker and Bootsy Collins. And David Edelstein reviews X2, X-Men United. Papa's got a brand new bag. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you.
James Brown is celebrating a birthday tomorrow, but we aren't sure which one. Some sources say he'll be 70, others say he'll be 75. We called our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, who said he'd put his money on 75. But whatever his age, James Brown deserves a birthday salute. And we're saluting him by revisiting interviews with two former James Brown sidemen. In a few minutes, we'll hear a conversation with bass player Bootsy Collins. But let's get started with Maceo Parker, with whom Terry spoke in 1989. He's the best-known saxophonist to emerge from the Godfather of Soul's horn section and recorded this hit with James Brown in 1967.
Oh! When you kiss me, oh, and you miss me, you hold me tight, make everything all right. I make up in a cold sweat. Maceo, come on now, brother, what it was that night.
Things James Brown told you about what he wanted from the horn section, what he wanted from you as a musician?
As the first thing, you know, had to do with the fact that I played baritone. And then when he heard me play baritone, he just said, okay, it seems like you can come up with, you know, your own part. Because I would listen to what he would tell the other horn players to play. And then I started playing something without him telling me anything. I started playing something. And then, it sounded okay, it sounded great. But, you know, if you're going to go into how I actually, you know, start doing a solo thing, how that came about, the guy doing the solo had to take off for, like, I guess a couple weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. And it was a rumor as to it's sort of like an uproar kind of a thing, is what we're gonna do now. The guy who plays the solo can't work for 3 weeks. What we're gonna do? Should we hire somebody? And I said, Mr. Brown, I can do that. I can play, you know, the sax solos. He said, well, okay, well, I'll give you a chance. You know, I can, you know, I give you a chance. And I was playing solo ever since.
Baby, 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 I'm on a.
What did James Brown tell you that he expected from you on stage in the way, you know, how you dressed, what kind of movements you did?
Well, I had been to a couple of shows. In fact, James Brown and his group was one of the people who I admired, you know, at that time. And I could tell that he was a little bit strict on dress and mood of character and all this kind of thing. And if you can notice and kind of, you know, kind of jot down things about a group when you visit a group, you kind of sort of know and learn what they expect without, you know, the person actually telling you that. But Once I got hired, or we got hired, you know, you got to be on time. You got to have your uniforms and stuff got to be intact. You got to have the bow tie. You can't come up without the bow tie. You can't come up without the cummerbund. Your shoes got to be, your patent leather shoes we wearing at the time. You got to be greased. You know, you just got to have this stuff. This is what I expect. And that was okay.
Did you get to, if you left the band, did you get to keep the costume?
No. No, he bought the costumes, he bought the shoes, and for some reason, if you decide to leave the group, please leave, please leave my uniforms with somebody.
When James Brown started playing funk, he started putting the accent on the first beat. When did he start telling you about the one in his music and putting the emphasis on the one?
He always liked to have a heavy one. That's what he felt. That was his style. Gonna have a funky good time. That's where the one is, like right there.
Was it hard for you to pick up on that, or did it seem natural?
It was hard when I had to solo, in that I'm used to hearing the accented beat being on two. Like if I would have done it, it would be gonna have a funky good time. Two and three and four. That's not normally how everybody was recording, and you could hear easily. I think their ear is easy to hear two and four, and that's where you clap. That's where the backbeat is normally.
Right.
You know, ting to tat, ting to tat, like that, two and four. But this was one. It was, and at first, like I said, at first it was a little awkward. But we became used to it.
Hit it. How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
There's so much bone, brother. How you feel, man? Call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, Jay! Sure getting down. Look at him! Ha. We're gonna have a funk good time. 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 Let's take him up, Fred.
Is it hard work working for the hardest working man in show business?
It was hard, but it was rewarding and it was fun because, you know, you're working with somebody who has this title, hardest working man in show business. That means you got to do your part. You got to keep up. And, you never want him to say, hey, man, you know, if I can do 10, 15 splits a night, you know, at least you guys can do play the little vamp or whatever it is, you know, for 45 minutes.
Good idea. Let's turn off the music. We turn off the music, then he'll come along with us, right? Let's turn it off.
Bite it.
The guy's still playing.
Still monkey down.
Brother can't hear. Yo, I know what, man. Let's leave and let's close the door. Let's lock him inside. Then he'll leave.
You better know it.
Come on, let's go. Close the door. Brother's still playing. Yo, man, I don't care. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Let's leave. Let's leave. Yo, Jerry, turn off the light. Click.
Maceo Parker spoke with Terry Gross in 1989. Coming up, an interview with another former James Brown band member, bass player Bootsy Collins. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our birthday tribute to James Brown, who turned 70, or maybe 75, tomorrow. In 1994, Terry spoke with James Brown alumni Bootsy Collins, one of the most celebrated funk bass players. Collins also spent years with George Clinton, combining funk with science fiction and psychedelics. Then Collins formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band, and created the stage persona Bootzilla. It was an oversized name to go with his flashy costumes and monster-sized eyeglasses. But it was James Brown who taught Bootsy Collins to play funk in the early 70s, when he was recording hits like Sex Machine and Superbad.
Watch me, watch me, I got it. Watch me, I got it. Hey, I got something that makes me want to shout. I got something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul and I'm super bad. I got soul and I'm super bad. Gotta move that tells me what to do. Sometimes it did. Now I gotta move that tells me what to do. Sometimes I feel so nice, I wanna try myself a few. I got soul and I'm super bad.
Well, listen, I went back to James Brown's autobiography to see what he had to say about you.
Yeah. Oh, good.
So he writes, I think Bootsy learned a lot from me. When I met him, he was playing a lot of bass.
Yeah.
The ifs, ands, and the buts.
Yeah, he's right.
I got him to see the importance of the one in funk.
Yeah.
The downbeat at the beginning of every bar.
That's right.
I got him to key in on the dynamic parts of the one.
That's right.
Instead of playing all around it.
Yeah.
Then he could do all of his stuff in the right places after the one.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Absolutely correct.
No, was it hard to make the adjustment to playing on the one?
No, because I knew he knew something. I mean, you know, and I was there to learn. It wasn't like, this is my party and I'll fly if I want to. I knew it was James's party, you know, and whatever he knew, I wanted to find out because, you know, he just had this, the band was the tightest band in the land and he had this thing going on. We wanted to find out what the heck it was, you know.
Now, had you been playing on the 2 and 4 before?
I started playing on the with a guitar, and I wasn't actually a bass player yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was learning to play bass, you know, and I wanted to play bass. So it was like all those other ifs, ands, and buts is what I was playing when I picked up the bass, you know. It was like, oh, you mean I got to play on the dominant note? Oh, okay. So it was like all brand new to me, you know, and I just didn't feel like a normal bass player, you know, so... But by James telling me that, it all kind of made sense. And once I started hearing it, you know, what was actually happening when I did that, it was like, oh, and then I can still do this and I can still do that. So it was a groove. It was really a groove.
Now let me play one of the recordings you made with James Brown. Why don't we hear Sex Machine? And do you want to say anything about the rhythm you're playing on this?
That's pretty much the whole rhythm is what I figure I've been doing ever since. When you hear Sex Machine, that's pretty much where I'm at now.
Okay, here we go.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead, go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene. Machine.
Get on up,
get up,
get on up,
stay on the scene,
get on up,
like a sex machine,
get on up,
wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm, stay on the scene, like a sex machine, you got to have the feeling, sure as your bone, get it together, right on, right on, get up,
get on up,
get up,
my guest is Bootsy Collins. Now, tell me how your image changed when you started playing with James Brown. What you did on stage, what you wore on stage.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. What I wore on stage. Oh, man. As you know, I may not know. Those were the days like in the 60s, getting ready to go into the 70s. But, you know, it was another kind of movement going on. And kids were like coming up front and wearing like bleached jeans and T-shirts and afros and, you know, the granny glasses, and, you know, we was all freaking out. We was having a freaking party, you know, and I don't know. Then here we are. We're playing with James Brown, and you know we're in the Army now. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, so it's like, but it was good for the fact that it kind of brought us off of the street. We were out there doing what everybody else was doing, acting crazy, throwing firebombs and doing everything, you know. So getting with James kind of brought us off of the street. And, you know, I think we kind of realized that. And at the same time, you know, it gave us the opportunity of really doing something that we wanted to do. So, you know, we kind of put everything else in the back seat because this is what we wanted to do. Even though, you know, we wanted to dress crazy. We didn't know how crazy we wanted to dress, but we didn't want to wear suits. You know, we knew that.
So you were wearing matching suits on stage while everybody else was wearing jeans and tie-dye T-shirts?
Yeah, while this movement was going on, the peace, the love, that was going on. And, you know, here we are, you know, getting stuck with wearing suits and patent leather shoes, you know. And but at that time, you know, it was the start of it, so it was cool, you know. We said, well, we'll eat this because, you know, we definitely, you know, want to be with James, you know, so... If you want to be with James, that's what you had to do.
So you left the band after just a couple of years.
Yeah.
What was the turning point for you that made you think, it's time now, I'm getting out?
Well, you know, I got you know, all the other bands was coming up wearing the freaky stuff that I said, well, wow, I could have did that 3 years ago, you know? And, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it was like that. And then it was like, you know, you just want to do things the way you want to do them on stage. You want to go crazy. You want to freak out, you know, because that's what time it was, you know. And here we were just standing up there being the tightest band in the land, but, you know, it was only a certain amount of movement you can do, you know. You couldn't jump out in the audience and freak out and act crazy, you know. Like, that's what it was going to, you know. And that's what we wanted to do, you know. We just wanted to have a low-down, hold-down, and, you know, drip-until-you-wet type party.
Let me play one of the classic Bootsy records. Why don't I play Bootzilla?
Oh, yeah.
Say something about writing and recording this.
Let's see. That was in, I think it was in 78, right? 1978. And we done that at the P-Funk Lab in Detroit. And it was George Clinton, myself. We just kind of went in and winged it. And all of a sudden, the monster was born. The rock star doll baby bubble. Yeah.
This is Bootsy Collins from his new Warner Brothers collection.
Yeah, but they're adorable. I come equipped with stereophonic, funk-producing, disco-inducing, twin magnetic pump receptors. Oh, I'm perfect for bumming, you see. Just wind me up. Put me on your credit charge, man. And at no extra expense comes this remote control unit. Oh, yeah, I'm programmable. One heck of a doll, baby mama. Bootzilla here! Made by the makers of funky things to play with. Trademark Funk Attack Incorporated, mama.
Pull my string, I'll dance, I'll sing, I'll
play. Yeah, but never do,
now, I want to ask you a couple things about your bass. You actually started off playing guitar.
Yeah.
And then you started using bass strings on the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's how you started playing bass. Well, why didn't you get a bass?
Money. I didn't have any money. You know, it was like my mother had bought me this guitar because I had begged her, you know, for years, right, about this one guitar, man. And she finally got it for me. And then I decided that I want to play bass, you know. And you know, it's like, right. Come on, man. It took me all these years to get this guitar, you know. So what it was my brother was, you know, he was like playing guitar, and I wanted to be in, I realized that I wanted to be in a band with him after I got a guitar. So how was I going to be in a band with him playing guitar? And he's the guitar player. So I decided, wow, I got to become the bass player. So that's when that big thing came up with, okay, well, I'll take some bass strings and I'll put them on my guitar and I'll play bass with him. You know, this was my big dream to just play with him.
I think James Brown gave you your first bass.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah.
What was it like learning to actually play bass on bass instead of on guitar?
Well, you know, the only difference, I think, was the neck was longer, you know, because the strings were pretty much the same. I had put bass strings on the guitar, so they were pretty much the same. It felt the same, but I think the neck was longer because James had got me this Fender Jazz bass, you know, and it was a long sucker, and it was like, whoa, wow, it was like a Cadillac, you know? Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing the interview.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine.
Terry Gross talking with Bootsy Collins in 1994. Collins was a bass player for James Brown, who celebrates a birthday this weekend.
Ah! Hey!
Coming up, a review of the new comic book movie X2, X-Men United. This is Fresh Air. The Marvel comic book X-Men was adapted into a hit film by Bryan Singer. Now Singer has directed a sequel called X2, also starring Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen as mutants. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Many superhero comic books operate on the principle that their readers will identify with freaky misfits, which won't be a surprise if you've been to any comic conventions. I say that with sympathy. I've been to a couple myself. Nowhere is this comic book alienation more explicit than in Marvel's X-Men, which takes off from the idea that evolution has produced a class of special people. They might be telepaths, they might be shapeshifters, they might raise storms or punch holes through things with their eyes, but they've all proudly taken the name mutants, which is like gay people taking the name queers, and they have parallels to gay people. They're fighting for their right to be who they are. If they're lucky, they get whisked away at an early age by Professor Xavier. He's the X of X-Men. He takes them to his mutant academy, where they learn to use their powers responsibly, and where they can bask in the glow of mutant fellowship. The first X-Men movie, directed by Bryan Singer, was surprisingly decent. It was rooted in that pain of otherness, and it had gravitas. The bigger fight wasn't against the humans, but the lunatic fringe of the mutant class, against Magneto, the most powerful mutant of all, played by Ian McKellen, and his sidekick, a slinky metamorph called Mystique, played by Rebecca Roman Stamos. These two were tired of being mistreated by humans. They wanted to dominate them, maybe even wipe them out. It fell to Professor X, played by Patrick Stewart, and his band of raging moderates to keep Magneto in line. The X-Men are all back in the wilder and funnier and more involving sequel, X2, X-Men United. There's Anna Paquin's Rogue, who kisses the boys and inadvertently sucks the life out of them, and Hugh Jackman's amnesiac Wolverine, with his retractable adamantine talons, and a couple of hottie mutants played by Halle Berry and Famke Janssen, who have new hairdos but not, unfortunately, more exciting personalities. The baddie this time is a military guy named Stryker, who's like a fanatical cold warrior. Played by the great Irish actor Brian Cox, Stryker wants to wipe out the mutant race. He's got Magneto a prisoner, he kidnaps Professor X, and then he sends his paramilitary units to snatch up all the mutant kids. The most intriguing part of the sequel is that Xavier's team and Magneto's team are on the same side. But is the enemy my friend? That's one of the movie's big teases. You get a clue which way it's going from this scene, where McKellen meets one of X's students, who's played by the hero of the movie Tadpole, Aaron Stanford. Unlike the more temperate mutants, this teenage fire wielder is just a little too in love with his power to singe.
So, they say you're the bad guy.
Is that what they say?
It's a dorky-looking helmet. What's it for?
This dorky-looking helmet is the only thing that's going to protect me from the real bad guys. What's your name?
John.
What's your real name, John?
Pyro.
Quite a talent you have there, Pyro.
I can only manipulate the fire. I can't create it.
You are a god among insects. Never let anyone tell you different.
That voice of McKellen's is incomparable. He plays Magneto as royally bored, the major questions of his existence having long been settled. He gets out of his non-metal prison by insouciantly pulling the iron out of the blood of a hapless guard. Then he sails out of his cell on an iron carpet. Singer, who directed The Usual Suspects, is a little cerebral for my taste. The climaxes don't have the oomph you get from more vulgar thriller directors. But the movie is in a different league from a standard Hollywood comic book blockbuster. It's never as simple as good versus evil. The three male titans, X, Magneto, and Stryker, are each convinced his way is right. My only complaint is that these mutants are a little, well, vanilla. I wish the X-Men had a touch of kinkiness to go with their weird abilities. As it stands, they're like Eagle Scouts with merit badges in telekinesis and energy sucking and instant freezing. I guess that's the difference between comic books and $100 million movies. Real deviants we save for indie movies and late-night cable.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate.
In 25 seconds, you can dance. You can beat off the ground. And if you believe, then you can fly. But if a man can dream, then he can fly.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Gravity! The big G!
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands, a novel set in 1951 Florida at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement by Susan Carroll McCarthy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the controversies about sending Christian missionaries into an Islamic country. We talk with Charles Kimball, a Baptist minister and author of the book When Religion Becomes Evil, and Albert Moeller, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, which hopes to send missionaries to Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.